Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming. This session is an opportunity for all of you to hear from three project leaders from the projects of Next Generation Learning Challenges Wave 1 about how they achieved the success that they did in improving outcomes for students. We're fortunate to have Kate Stevenson from California State University, Northridge, John Squires from Chattanooga State Community College, and Steve Lawn from the University of Michigan, who is filling in for Tim McKay, the project lead from Michigan, who couldn't be with us. The Next Generation Learning Challenges is an EDUCAUSE initiative that is really seeking to do a number of things, one of which is investing in technology projects that have potential to improve outcomes. But that's not the only thing we do. We work across both the K-12 and the higher education spheres, as you can probably deduce from the images on this slide. And we work through a number of partners. EDUCAUSE is our managing partner. We also work with the League for Innovation and the Community College. And on the K-12 side, the Council of Chief State School Officers, which is the organization behind the Common Core, and INACOL, the International K-12 Online Association, the International Online Association for K-12 Online Learning. I think I put online in there twice. Anyway, we have funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and we were also funded in our first wave by the Hewlett Foundation. We have three approaches to our work, the first of which is making those grants, investing in innovation. And secondly, we seek to take what happens when those grants are carried forward out into the wider field so that the successes, the learning experiences, even the failures can get out into the field and influence the direction of future work. And through that, we hope to multiply adoption of the best ideas rather than the continual need to reinvent new versions of things that may be only slightly different from what's gone before. Wave one of our work began in April 2011 and went on through October 2012 and in some cases a bit longer, so not even 2 years. And the funding that was awarded to 29 projects at that point had one idea of scaling an innovation from one campus to other campuses, and more importantly perhaps, demonstrating that that innovation, data proven, could lead to improved outcomes for students, either persistence, retention, better grades, some improvement in student outcomes. So the three project leaders who are here with us today actually did succeed in getting data that demonstrated that students had improved. And what they're going to be talking about with you today is some of the practical questions that arose as they were doing that work. How did they decide what questions they were going to ask? How did they get the cooperation from other people, both on their own campus and on other campuses where the implementation was going forward? And how did they, in fact, arrive at convincing data to show that they'd improved outcomes for students? Kate, over to you.
Hello, morning. So I'm Kate Stevenson from Cal State Northridge. Cal State Northridge is part of the Cal State system, which has 23 campuses. My campus by itself has about 30,000 students. So that's a good, rich data set. I'm a mathematician by training, and I'm also the director of developmental math at Cal State Northridge. So our project was, the goal of our project was to bridge the gap between where we think they are and what we think they do and what they where they actually are and what they actually do. And that's in any gateway, multi-section, high failure rate course. Okay. So a typical gateway, entry level, high failure rate course could be college algebra across the United States. And this is a typical picture of how students do in college algebra. The red line represents the D's, F's, and W's, and the blue line represents A's and B's. And you'll notice that it's about 2-to-1. Going back from fall 2006 to the data there, I have it up through spring 2011. A frustrating story. And it comes out of the traditional model in which we take a student, we look at it, at that student's transcript, and we say, okay, you're ready for college algebra, off you go. And it doesn't matter whether they took the prerequisites 4 years ago, 25 years ago, last year, but over the summer they went to Europe and forgot it all. We don't know where they really are and what they're really doing, with the net result that we end up with about two-thirds of them recycling through. And for a large state university, that's a serious cost, because we're paying for students to take courses over and over again. So what we need to do is look at why this is happening. And we know why it's happening. It's weak prerequisites, it's poor transition between class time and independent work time, and it's poor coordination across these multi-sections. So what students are able to do is sort of look around and say, what's the lowest common denominator of investment, and that's where I'm going to hit. So we need to change that culture. And my first question to throw out to all of you is, are you really ready to change this? Do you have the buy-in? Do you have the resources, and do you have the culture? And the resources are not just money. They are, do you have the cooperation of your IT? Are they going to give you the data that you need? Are they going to give you the course connections that you need? Do you have the faculty that are going to resist, or are you got people that are ready for the innovation? And that can be down to the culture of a course level. You might have that culture within one course and not within another. You may have that culture within one campus and not in another. And then from my own experience, I hit some resistance. So what should I have done? How should you handle it when you find that something that has worked in one situation, you hit resistance in another? So that's the first question to keep in mind. And we're going to cycle back to these questions at the end. And we want to talk about the ones that you have some experience or some questions about. So what was the first thing we did? Remember, we're trying to solve three problems. We're trying to improve their prerequisite knowledge, improve their time on task, and improve the coordination across multiple sections. So here's the traditional model. We toss a student in, and they go to lecture, they do some homework, they take some tests, and this is what's recycling two-thirds of our students through. So the obvious thing we do next, it's common across all universities, is we toss in some supplemental instruction. Maybe that'll make it go away. And usually it helps a little bit, but the problem is we haven't actually touched the root problem. We still don't know what they don't know, and we don't know, therefore, in the supplemental instruction, how to help them. So we've got this beautiful course materials. Maybe we've coordinated all the sections, but for the students, this is a shiny wall that they can't grab onto because they can't pay attention to the beauty of profit is maximized when marginal revenue equals marginal cost, because they're saying, what do I do with that fraction? Oh my God, how do I multiply decimals? So they're buzzing in their minds about some prerequisite issue. They're not listening to me on my beautiful lecture notes. So we need an element that can tailor that remediation so that it makes these beautiful materials that we've developed accessible to that student. And that's where the fourth piece, the kind of center of the wheel, comes in. If we can tailor their remediation so that, or their prerequisite knowledge, so that each person is working in that zone where they're going to get the most out of it, we're going to get more buy-in from the student. We're going to see the faculty say, wow, you know, they didn't know this in the beginning, and now they do, and now my lecturing is going a little bit better. And it's going to feed into all parts of our program. It's going to make the student better able to attend to lecture. It's going to make the supplemental contact hour more focused on their needs. It's going to make them better prepared for their homework, and hopefully they're going to be able to demonstrate this. So we call this a flow of learning, where the student is on an upward spiral. So here's the data that we have from the original implementation at Cal State Northridge in a business math class, which is between 800 to 1,000 students a semester. So this is pretty reasonable size data. And what you'll notice is in the fall of 2006, that's that first data point, that's when I taught the pilot class. That was 60 kids in two sections with me killing myself, doing the supplemental instruction myself on my own time. But what I learned from that, and this is an important lesson, was exactly what they did and didn't know and how varied that was from one student to another. So I developed my beautiful course materials, and I had a psychopath for a chair who said, good, let's go to full scale, all 800, using your materials next semester, where you see the next data point. So not so awesome. Now, at that point, we hadn't added in any supplemental instruction. We added supplemental instruction. You see some modest gains in the next data point in the fall of 2007. Where you see it switches, where you see that most of the time we've got more people getting A's and B's than getting D's, F's, and W's, is where you see the hybrid model. That's when we got all five components working synchronously. And honestly, we never looked back. It has been nothing but steady, steady, deeper knowledge going on with these students from that point. So the difference between, and this is something to keep in mind, the difference between success and failure sometimes is not incremental. And you really have to wait until you've got all the pieces together. Now, just because you cleaned your closets doesn't mean they stay clean. So if we cast our eyes towards spring 2012, oops, a whole bunch of new faculty came in. Maybe I didn't train them so well. But you see, we bounced back. The key to bounce back, the key to being able to bounce back, is your data. So one of the points I want to get across is you need to think in advance, what is the data you want to collect and who is the audience for that data? Because some of the data is the audience are the people giving you money. Some of the data needs to feed back to the people who are investing their time and talent in the class that they're teaching so that they feel like they're part of a success team. Nobody wants to work on something that's going to be a failure. They want to work on something that they feel is going to be success. If you can give data back to faculty saying, students know this, 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 and, but they're stuck right here, that focuses their energy. So if they're creating course materials, they know where to look at those course materials. So we collect data on every student and every problem. Now, it's not just true at Cal State Northridge. We've managed to bring this out now to 15 of the 23 CSU campuses in varied courses, mostly college algebra, business math, trigonometry, but now we're starting to work in calculus. And you see this is Cal State Monterey Bay, which has a similar swap between, this is the breakdown between pass and fail, which is roughly the same. So the C's are now contained in the blue line. That's why they go so high up. So one thing to think about, what should you do when folks won't share data with you? So again, you need to be intentional about your data. What data am I trying to collect? And how do I convince the people who have to give me the data that it's worth their time? So there has to be something that they get back. It's a sales pitch. And then here's Cal State Long Beach, which took our business math class and implemented it sort of kit and caboodle there. And you see, you know, up and down, up and down. And then when they really had all of the materials built and coordinated, they saw positive progress. So again, we need to give things some time to achieve success. You can't just implement a little piece and say, oh, that little piece didn't do anything. We need to give projects time to work. So my last question to you, because this was one of the scenarios that happened to me, what happens when people come out at the end and they say, oh, you know that data that we asked you to collect? Turns out we need different data. So I'm wondering if any of you have been in that situation, I can share my scenario with what happened there. And now I'm going to pass it over to John.
I'm John Squires. I'm the head of the math department at Chattanooga State Community College, and we were the Do the Math project, which involved Chattanooga State, Jefferson in Kentucky, and Maui in Hawaii. My motto is always, if you're going to do a grant, include Hawaii. So I'm going to talk about our data-driven approach. Step one, look at existing data. Step two, chart a different course. And step three, keep examining data. I want to focus on step one first, which is look at the existing data. And the question is, that you should be asking is, how effective is our current approach? And here's what I have discovered working with colleges around the nation and in my own department. Often the answer is, we have no idea. That's the truth, okay? I've had faculty conversations over and over again about data, and usually it's not a case that they don't want to look at it or aren't willing to look at it, they just have no idea what it is, okay? Once you get to actual data, sometimes the answer is not very effective. For example, 2007 study by TBR showed a 3% graduation rate for students at lowest levels of developmental studies. 3% graduation rate. Hard to call that effective, right? Chattanooga State, 2% graduation rate for students in developmental math. Again, there's just no way you can call that effective under any guise of any stretch of the imagination. Our success rates in our case were in the 40s, sometimes in the 30s. You know, it's just hard to call those numbers effective. So one of the things that I want to stress is we became convinced that we could do better by doing something different. But we had to start with the existing data and convince ourselves that we could do better. Once we did that, we charted a different course. We examined existing successful models. We said, how can they be applied to our situation, and how do we take them and build on? Those are the two questions. If you get faculty involved in those conversations, then that helps to get the buy-in, which is very important. Our approach really is threefold. Number one, we were going to try something completely different, something radically different, okay? Once I became convinced that it wasn't working, I'm not going to continue that system. Number two, emphasize teamwork. Teamwork is essential to buy-in, and it's also essential to the whole process. And number three, stress continuous improvement. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you everything we did worked right off the bat, but what I am going to tell you is when it didn't work, we came together and we said, okay, what went wrong? How can we get it to work? And really, it's really a teamwork and continuous improvement are really the keys to this whole thing as far as the impact we've had. Let me talk briefly about what we did, but if you want more information on that, you can email me. I'm not going to go into great detail. We did a variation of the Emporium model. We did mastery learning, which means they don't move on if they don't get it. We did mini modules, which increases engagement because they aren't waiting until the night before the test to do something. Mini modules are weekly expectations. We do the continuous enrollment plan, which means, and we do this throughout our curriculum at Chattanooga State. If they finish early, they can go right on to the next course. We do that throughout the curriculum. We actually had a student complete pre-calculus, calculus, and calculus two last semester, and all in the same semester. So we do different things like that, and it's all about high tech, high touch. High tech gives you that efficiency of knowing where they're at, and high touch, they still need the people, they need contact and connections with those instructors. That's what it's about, but hopefully the instructor is connecting with them in a way that the student needs them to be connecting with them. Our developmental math rates have gone from 48 to 65%. College math has increased from 66 to 74. We were never in the 70s in college math before this project. We've seen achievement gaps close. We've seen gender, race, and income gaps close. We tracked low-income students at Chattanooga State as part of the Next Generation Project. And we tracked them in terms of course success, in terms of retention, and in terms of accelerated learning, how the continuous enrollment plan. And across the board in all three areas, there was absolutely no gap between them and the other students, which was great to see. And the long-term impact, we've been doing this for a while now, is that college math now exceeds developmental math by a long ways. For the last seven semesters, college math has exceeded developmental math. The gap is just getting wider and wider and wider. The gap now is 900 students. When I went to Chattanooga State, we had 500 more students in developmental math than college level math. This spring, we have 900 more students in college math than in developmental math. Students succeeding in college math is up 45%. Yes, sir. We have a question.
Are you finding success?
Yeah. ABC. Yeah, ABC. Yeah. All right. We have since taken this to high schools. I actually did a Next Generation Learning blog on this. We have expanded our dual enrollment opportunities through blended learning. We have put developmental math in this same format in the senior year. We actually this year got a $1.1 million grant from the governor. We're in 120 high schools, impacting 8,400 students this year. Next year we'll get $2.6 million from the governor to do the same thing. And this really is very exciting, because what it does is it goes to the root of the problem, puts developmental math in the senior year, but it also expands dual enrollment opportunities for those students, those at-risk students. Right now, dual enrollment is available to the good students. But those at-risk students, they aren't getting a head start, are they? Well, this expands those head start opportunities for all students, including the at-risk ones. And finally, keep examining data. You have to ask yourself what data is important to look at. That's a very important question. And then once you determine that, whether it's how did they do on a specific exam, or how did they do in the course, or how did they were they retained, did they graduate, those are all important things. But once you do that, it's important to go back and examine data, both short-term and long-term. When you're implementing a new program, you might not be able to do long-term right away, obviously. But you can get long-term data on the existing data to keep reminding yourself of why you're doing this. Transparency helps build buy-in, quite honestly. When things don't go right, you got to look your faculty in the eye and say, that's okay. Let's get it. What do we need to do to fix it? You know. But look forwards, don't look back, and don't be afraid to ask those tough questions. Okay? That's it for me.
Hi, I'm Steve Lawn. I'm not Tim McKay. So Tim was unable to join us today, but I'm going to pull his notes up on my phone here. I've had the pleasure to see Tim's project go from when he first got the NGLC grant as kind of a close outsider. So I'm not necessarily part of Tim's group, but we collaborate fairly well in the learning analytics overall kind of scope at Michigan. So here I go. So Tim's project is all at least started in college physics. So, but even more broadly than just physics, we have really large classes at big research universities. We're talking like 800-person classes. They're really impersonal. By saying that when we say something to the students and say, you need to read the homework and you need to take the past exam, that may not be true for every student in that 800-person lecture. So we say the same thing in the same way to every student. And that kind of support should be more tailored. We have the ability to say that we should take your goals into account. We should take your current status, your confidence, your kind of trajectory. Are you pre-med? Are you pre-law? Are you trying to get an engineering? So the idea is that computer-tailored communication, and I'll talk about MTS, or Michigan Tailored System, in a second here, can really provide this kind of functionality at scale. And the personalization of education is kind of a big theme within learning analytics. So this is Tim's chalkboard that he had in his office way back before the project began, right after he got the grant. And they have 1,900 students to take some sort of physics class every term. So there's a lot of students. So all those are four large introductory physics classes. And the thing I want to know is this, the arrow right here on the right-hand side that goes all the way back, it says research on it, because the idea is that as you go through this whole process, that research informs what happens, and it actually improves the process. We can improve the messages over time using the data that we collect. So this is a busy slide. So this is, again, tailored support from physics students. It's the Michigan Tailoring System. It's called eCoach or E2Coach, which is electronic expert. And really the thing to kind of take away from this is that Tim talks about is really we want to improve performance not just for the students who are not completing or not doing well in physics. We want to improve the performance for all students. Can the students get an A? Can we increase the depth for their learning? And really, what would you say to every student if you could? I'll return that again. So how does this work? This is the Michigan Tailoring System. And the unique thing in the theme of how do you get help from other folks on campus, this is one of those classic Michigan things, because Michigan's huge, and you know, we have like two big campuses. Like, I never know what other people are doing. I catch up with them at conferences. So Tim was talking with a colleague one day and said, what do you do? Well, I do this stuff in public health. We have this system, and we've developed it, and we've turned it into open source. And basically, it helps people like maintain their diabetes and maintain their help them quit smoking by kind of giving them a tutor and an electronic coach to help them get through that. And Tim was like, I could apply that to education. I could do that for my physics students. So we could take the expertise of hundreds of students, dozens of instructors, and behavioral change experts, and put that logic into the system. And what it does, it takes all the detailed information about all the students and their current status and puts it into the system. And out comes individually personalized messages. What would we say to every single individual student if we could? If every student, like all 800 every week, came to office hours, what would you say? And really, this is where the effort lies, is in the left, this kind of left and top part, because it is really hard to get that information. That, you know, as instructors, we think, well, you know, I know what to say, but it's not going to have a lot of cachet for students. It's going to be like, well, you know, Professor McKay, or you know, even you, Steve, you look kind of younger than Tim, but you know, it was a long time since you were an undergrad. Why should I listen to you? My roommate. I trust my roommate. So it's gathering data from students who have been this and delivering the messages in a way that says, I'm your peer. And you know, for me, taking physics 101, it was really hard, and I was afraid it was going to lower my GPA, and I was never going to get into med school. So delivering information like that to students in a way that is personalized and means to them. So this was the first iteration of eCoach. And this is the message they get. You got an 80% exam one. You did better than you thought you would. So the students kind of say, what, I think I'm going to get an exam. And then it returns back to them, well, here's how you did. Is that better or worse? And then kind of gives them more information. It's really hard to read that. Sorry. So yeah, that's kind of the information they get from them, and it's tailored to their background and their information. And so we ask them kind of like, what grade are you hoping for? Here's how you are so far. This kind of where you are in the progress. You can play with things. So I'm going to pretend that, you know, I get like 80 on the remaining exams, and that will tell me kind of where I end up. So you can kind of play with that and kind of do what students normally do now, but leverage technology to make it visual. And to make it mean to them. And then, you know, here's your score, the grade distribution. Here's things you can do to maybe do better next time, given who you are and what your goals. So I want to talk about the first three terms of eCoach. It's now been in four terms as of last fall. So the important thing to know that Tim did about 10 years of data mining. Before he implemented eCoach. What they really found is, not surprisingly, most students coming in, their GPA kind of is the driving factor. So GPA accounts for 30% of the variance. So SAT and ACT only predict about 13%, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff. So Tim came out with this factor called better than expected. It basically takes your grade and takes the dispersion for every other student who got their grades who has the same GPA you do. So you're going to compare against all the other students who are coming into physics with a 3.8 or a 2.4, whatever you have. And then we're going to compare that with the entire grades for all the students in the class. So you get this kind of nice math equation called better than expected. And the so then they divided this into four user groups. People didn't use the eCoach at all. People who used it a little bit, a medium, and high users. And that's both on number of times they hit the tool and also how many different weeks, because they want to look at how many different kind of messages they got through the course of the term. So this is a bunch of stats that are really hard to read, especially back there. I don't have a lot of time to go through them. No, I don't want to trash the message. These are Tim's notes. So the thing, and there's more stats there. So there's three terms. The thing Tim wants me to note on this one is this. I'll never get this right. So that women are more likely than men to sign up. The male fraction falls with engagement. So the high users have higher. Well, while high users have higher GPAs because
and not surprisingly, students who are always successful use the resources we provide them. That's fairly common. But we compare that performance to non-users who have the same high BGP as you do. When we compare across user groups, we don't necessarily care what GPA they're coming in with. But even that, so the non-users, it's flat, using this better than expected kind of metric again. So non-users look flat because we're comparing to them. So the people who probably could really use this tool and really get a lot out of it, they didn't use it for so much. Maybe they just didn't find it useful, or they were kind of jittery about it, or they didn't like the feedback. So their actual performance went down. But the modern high users, you can see they have really decent gains. Am I supposed to say anything else? Not about that one. What am I supposed to say about this slide? I don't remember. So this is again showing that there's not a lot of difference in the SAT and ACT scores. The additional information gathered through eCoach provides rich resources. So this is high school physics. So one of the things that Tim does every term is he has a survey. And while you can get some of the stuff from the admissions records, and we know kind of they took high school physics, it's not very descriptive. In a survey, we can ask students not only when did you take physics, was it AP? I'm up on time, here's my quick last point. We can ask them, did your high school physics suck? You know, was it really cool? Was it useless? But you can see that the high school performance in physics has a significant impact. So there's more stuff we have installed the gender gap. There's still a gender gap in physics, so that's one thing we'd like to address. And here's all the different scenarios.
Right, so I think each of us described our programs, and rather than talking further about our programs, we wondered, of the questions that we've raised, these are the questions that we raised during our talks, we wondered if there were any particular ones of those that were of interest to you who are out there. So why don't you take a second to look at those questions, and if nobody has a preference, we'll just take turns. Is there any one of those that catches your eye, or is there any question that's even more interesting that we didn't even bring up? Okay. If not, then I think that what I'll do is, you know, between hitting these are the classics, right? Hitting resistance to change, what do I do when people won't share data, and what should I do with after the fact? Which one would do? I see a nod to all three. I think yes. Oh, yes, we have online people, so if you don't mind speaking into the mic.
We have a lot of resistance. People don't want to share data because they're afraid of things like people going to use my stuff unfairly.
Exactly.
And they don't understand what belongs to them and what belongs to the university.
Yes, I think that's very common, and we heard it from our brothers and sisters in Wave 1 across the board, is a fear of data. And I think John spoke to this as well, that people don't even know what the data is because they're honestly afraid. And I can tell you, when I first looked at those graphs, you know, going back to 2006, I didn't look at those until a few years later when I had the courage to go to my institutional research. I had the final exam data. I knew that students were learning more, but oh God, I don't assign the grades. What if they're still assigning lousy grades and just the final exam was getting better? The physical sensation of relief to see that the official data of the university backed up the data that I was collecting on the final exam, problem by problem and aggregate, was tremendous and tremendously powerful for the buy-in. So when you present people, and let's face it, a lot of these courses are technology courses, math, science, STEM courses. If you present skeptics with data, they will argue with you on a different level. It ceases to become I'm so terrified. Oh, that gives us something to discuss. Like, that course was unsuccessful. If I show that college algebra data to somebody and then I show the business math data, because these are the same cohort of students, we can now have a reasonable and rational discussion. And also they see that we've been using this data for many years and we've never actually hung anybody out to dry because their section did really badly. So it's a matter of forming trust. So my advice is start with a course where the culture, or a department or a program, where the culture is ready for this kind of an implementation. That was my experience, by building the trust slowly over time. Yes, there's a question in the back, if you don't mind coming to the microphone, and it can be for any of us. Oh, sorry, one, two.
Well, I want to congratulate you first on making the gains that you've made. The question that I have is, it seems like the gains are fairly moderate. I mean, if we are still only having 65% or whatever of people in these basic math and science classes actually being successful, that still seems like there's a lot of room for improvement. What do you think can move us
to the next level?
To the next level, because it seems like we're not at 40%, but 60, 60% is still
tough.
Low.
Tough. Yeah, I mean, I'll let John speak on this as well, but I think that if you're coming from a large comprehensive or community college, there is the issue of preparedness and student input. So what we have to do is make sure that we can sleep at night, that we have given them every resource within our disposal to make it possible for them to succeed. So the next step has to be something more on the level of attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs, something about breaking down that resistance to investing. And often that resistance is based in fear. I don't know if, John, you want to say a word or two.
Well, you're right. There's always room for improvement. Having said that, 60 is significantly better than 40. So that's that's not, but I think in my case, in a community college, let me just walk you briefly through my take on it. We have a large percentage of underprepared students, wildly underprepared students, who can't do 5 times 4. We have a very low income population who, finances an issue. And we have the, what I call the crazy stories crowd and the gamers. Students will be doing fine, but their transmission tore up, so then they don't show up to school ever again. I mean, it's things don't make sense. You also have the gamers who show up for the financial aid check and you never see them again. Those two crowds probably comprise about 15% of your population. And my theory is if I can get 80 to 90% of the rest of them through, I'm happy. That would put you in the 70s, not the 60s, so I would hope we're in the 70s eventually. Having said that, I think our remaining challenge, quite honestly, is the very lowest level student. They can't do 5 times 4. How do we get that accomplished? If we can get them to where they can solve x+1=2, we've done something. If we can get them to where they're actually familiar with their multiplication facts, we've done something. But quite honestly, they're kind of the missing piece, in my opinion, as far as our remaining challenge. And I think over the next few years at Chattanooga State, I plan to kind of rethink developmental math, because as our numbers drop, which is great, we are left with that lowest level student. So
can I just follow up on that really quickly?
Sure.
Have you considered partnering with local school districts to kind of push some of your ideas down into the elementary, middle school, high school areas? Because,
well, we've started with the senior year, okay? And yes, we would like to go on down and so forth, but we have, right now I'm leading a project, 120 high schools, 8,400 students this year. The senior year, let's disrupt business as usual in the senior year. Let's push these ideas down and let's go in and stop this cycle where they take a senior level math course and then they retest the ACT and then they come to developmental and then they, it's an insane cycle if you think about that whole high stakes testing cycle we put them through. So we go into the senior year and we offer them this opportunity to get a head start, and it's going wonderfully. And by the way, an amazingly low level of resistance from the high schools in doing this, which has been great to see. So that's our starting point. Yes, we'd like to go from there. We're actually starting on reading and writing next year doing that. But, I think that's the key to the whole thing, is to go down and work with the high schools to solve the problem together.
I actually have a couple of questions, if I can. I have one first for Catherine and then one for John. So, Catherine, when you're asking folks to share their data, and I apologize if you said this,
sure.
Is that based on the grades the students have in the class, or do you have some standardized method of making sure that the same grades mean the same thing?
That's an excellent question. So what we do for, and this is really tricky across multiple campuses, so as much as possible, we try and coordinate on the level of institutional research so that we don't have issues of FERPA problems, so that an institutional research office is sharing it across one system, and that's actually been pretty easy to set up. The tricky part is getting the data which is actually most actionable, which is the student level, problem level data. And the only way to get that is to get buy-in, which means that as soon as you collect that data, you have to shoot a message back to the people who provided you that data saying, hey, the place you might want to focus on is here. Now listen to what I'm saying and compare it to the program that's helping those physics students. Isn't that the same thing? Somehow we think that we can just require stuff of faculty without giving them any kind of scaffolding and any kind of buy-in coming back towards them. So I think we have to think about redesign, not just on the student learning level, but also on the faculty learning level. How can we give them actionable items? And I found every time I gave faculty actionable items, they were willing to do overtime to fix, it's just that they hate piecewise functions. And, look, what did we assign for homework? What did we do? People are willing to do that because it's a bite-sized task. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, thank you. So, John, I have kind of a functional question about you because I was really interested in this continuous enrollment.
Yep.
Do you do that for the developmental classes too?
Yes. We had 380 students last year complete multiple courses in one semester.
So then my functional question is, how do you do that on the transcripts and the transactional end of what they're enrolled in? And
the answer is you've got to bring everyone to the table. We had meetings with our registrar, with IT, with financial aid, with veterans affairs, with student records, so forth. We brought everyone to the table and we said, look, this is, what we need to do. TBR had actually kind of informally mandated it, referenced it in their policies, and we said, look, TBR is behind this. We can do this. Let's come together and get a solution. Those solutions are rather creative, but we do it. And in all cases, I've done it at two institutions now, and in both cases, we did the same thing. We brought two people together, and we said, look, we've got this great opportunity to impact retention, to impact success, to impact graduation. Let's find solutions. Let's not make excuses. And we've been able to do that. It's pretty cool when you do that. You get students engaged, you'll find you have a different problem. It's a good problem to have, which is they're really engaged and they're really doing well. What do you do then?
We are about out of time. I'd like to thank our presenters, and especially to thank Steve, who stepped up as of Monday to deliver this presentation that Tim had put together. So thanks so much.
Thank you.